Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And with me, once again, one of my favorite guests is Sherry Winston. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, Diana. Thanks so much for having me back again.
Oh, you're welcome. Did you get my most recent communication that we might start the show with sexual history, your sexual stories?
I think that's a great place to begin. You know,
okay.
Because really, you know, I was suggesting we talk about partner skills, but I think your point, which is something that I begin with all the time also, is that really our sexual relationships begin with our relationship with ourselves. That's the
yes.
beginning point. So great place.
And we will talk also about your suggestions for more erotic communication and succulent sex craft for partners. You have in your book, well, let me just remind listeners, if they haven't heard a show with you before, of course, there are many in the archives, that Sherry Winston is a celebrated sexuality teacher. She's an award-winning author and medical professional, and you bring over two decades, maybe it's close to 25, maybe years now, something like that.
It's hard to tell.
Experience.
I don't know. It's
you've got to do
time.
The math on that. But you're a certified nurse, midwife, a gynecology practitioner. What does that last part mean, the gynecology practitioner? It's tied in with a nurse, midwife, I guess.
Yeah, sure. So when I was doing clinical practice, which I'm not anymore, but that means I could do pap smears, I can diagnose conditions, I can write prescriptions, I can do birth control. So it's sort of, you know, your basic gynecology care, anything that doesn't require a specialist.
Yeah. And Sherry is also, you are really an amazing, fabulous artist. And one reason your book, Succulent Sex Craft, and I know you have another one, but we're going to focus on Succulent Sex Craft for this show. So you, with Succulent Sex Craft, you have lots of ideas about making the most of your sexuality. And by starting with your sexual history, you know, I think it's interesting to think about what it might mean. You know, some of my clients, the first session, we pretty much always get a sexual history. But mm-hmm. I've had people tell me after they've contemplated this that there are lots of lessons to be learned when you look at your sexual history and talk about it, maybe with a sex therapist like myself or with somebody like you. Or with a good friend or with your lover. You know, you mm-hmm. want to be vulnerable. But everybody, it seems, has learned something from their sexual history eventually. And I think that true sexual patterns don't emerge for a year or more. And so that's why taking your time and being patient and getting to know somebody will help you learn even more how your sexual history contributes to your sexual activity now.
Yeah, you see, because we are creatures both of nature and nurture. So there's part of our sexuality that's our biological template. It's our animal nature. We are animals, and there's parts of our sexuality that are just innate. And because we're human, an enormous part of our who we are as sexual beings is learned. And it isn't even the learning like, you know, oh, I went to sex ed when I was in high school to a class. It's the learning that you've gotten every moment. You were learning while you were getting born. You learned when your diapers were being changed and how you were taught how to name or not name your body parts. And so mm-hmm. we have been learning about sex like sponges. Mm-hmm. And most of that learning, or at least a lot of that learning, is often very unconscious. we haven't really thought about it. And so a great first step is to start thinking, what did I learn? What messages did I absorb without even being conscious of them? Because once we bring them up into our awareness, then we have the option of going, oh, you know, I got a message that my genitals are ugly and dirty and shameful. Wow, that's not useful. I want to reprogram that. But that all begins, you know, with figuring out what's actually going on deep inside. What did we learn? So I love starting with that.
Yes,
what are the
and just the,
significant
just,
messages?
Yes, and just as an aside, there is research to show and experiential things that we've learned as clinicians, as sexologists, that somebody, a woman in particular, who really likes her genitals is way more likely to have good sex, great sex, because she accepts her body and how she looks. And then if she has a partner who also is very accepting and loving all of her, then she's much more likely to be responsive and orgasmic. And you want to talk about that a little bit or comment?
I would love to. So you mentioned that I was a midwife and a nurse practitioner.
Yeah.
So as part of that, of course, I was doing lots of pelvic exams for many, many years. And I have to say, when I first started, so now we're talking, I don't know, many, many decades ago, count.
Mm-hmm,
when I first
mm-hmm.
started, I was actually shocked by how many women were disgusted by their own genitals and also didn't think that they were normal, that there was something wrong with their particular set of genitals. And so I actually developed a practice that I wound up teaching and doing trainings for other healthcare providers that I used to call the Empowering Pelvic Exam. How to give a woman a pelvic exam that was going to help her learn to enjoy, appreciate her genitals, heal that shame, and have it be actually a really good and empowering experience instead of the horrific thing that a lot of women think of or uncomfortable or really yucky part of their exam. So I think that is one of the places with our healthcare providers where we can heal that. I think also we can heal that with ourselves. Hopefully we're raising our children to not have that genital shame. That would be the ideal thing for the next generations that come. And it's something we also can help our partners with, where we can help them love and accept and enjoy and appreciate these wonderful, pleasurable, fantastic body parts that we've got that enable us to have lots of pleasure and have babies and, you know, other useful things. So that's a really important thing to me. And I just want to add one more piece of this about the normalness of the incredible range and variety of what genitals look like, and that is that I think this has gotten worse with the advent of porn.
There's kind of a
porn model of what genitals should look like or what size they should be, and it's not very realistic. In fact, some of those porn actors and actresses have had surgery to get their genitals to look like that, or you know, they're chosen because they look a certain way. Their body looks a certain way. They're you know, obviously breast augmentation surgery is common in that field, and so there's even more unrealistic expectations of what bodies and genitals should look like. And so I think we have an even harder time now accepting, loving, and enjoying our bodies than ever, which is really sad.
It's sad, and from what I understand, many women, particularly in places like Los Angeles, are getting labiaplasties to make their labia look more equal, like you see in porn. And
not only more equal, but smaller. That's the kind of the classic
smaller,
the
right?
The Barbie vulva, right? Where it's all very
Barbie doll doesn't even have any genitals.
that's what they're trying to look like.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Labiaplasty and other genital modification surgeries are one of the fastest growing areas of plastic surgery and have been for about 15 years.
15 years, wow.
Yeah, tracks directly to porn. And it's really sad because those surgeries can have really bad side effects like scarring and numbness and pain.
And so you lose pleasure that way potentially.
Sure. You certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very counterproductive. I meant to say a few minutes ago that your book is especially useful in terms of your drawings because you're such a fine artist, and the fact that you worked as a midwife and saw lots of vulvas and vaginas, and it really informs your artwork. And I remember when I first heard you speak in about 2013, maybe it was 2014, but it was at the ASEC conference in Monterey, or was it Quad S? Mm-hmm. It was one of those. Anyway.
I think it was Monterey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was Monterey, I know that. But
yeah,
I first became aware of vestibular bulbs thanks to you, and you have a wonderful drawing of vestibular bulbs in your book, which I have made copies of, you know, noting, giving credit to you, and your page 124. It's very useful for partners to know about this, and tell us why the vestibular bulbs.
Well, I'll frame it in the sort of big picture, which is that people with vulvas have an enormous amount of erectile equipment, erectile tissue, which is the same stuff that penises are mostly made out of, and we don't know where most of it is. So until we know where all the parts are, how are we going to know how to play with them and how to make them happy and how to get them all engorged? And in fact, when we get the whole network of structures engorged, it really amplifies pleasure. And so it's like most of us are playing the piano and we think we have 22 keys on our piano. And it's like, nope, you got 88 keys on your piano and you got foot pedals. So I think it's essential if we want to access all of the pleasure that we're capable of, that we know where all the pleasure parts are, how they connect, how to make them happy. We need to know that if we own the equipment. I think partners who like to play with that equipment also need to know. And I know for me, once I started figuring this out, and it took me years, what I call now my hunt for buried pleasure, but it took me years to figure it all out and find it and figure out how it connected and what was going on. For me, it really brought my level of pleasure up like a quantum leap once I found all the parts and, of course, informed all of my partners of all the parts. And, a good time was had by all.
Sure. So if your partner, male or female, lightly munches on your labia as part of the sex play, that can bring more blood to those vestibular bulbs and thus more arousal. And your drawing shows very clearly how the vestibular bulbs are absolutely tied in with the whole clitoral system, the leg, the shaft. And your drawing is just really excellent. A lot of people don't have a clue about vestibular bulbs. So,
I didn't either. I was already working as a midwife and a nurse practitioner and a childbirth educator. And before that, I was a massage therapist and a registered nurse. And I had studied anatomy 5 times in my professional education, including owning the anatomy, including being a specialist in this equipment before I discovered, I read about the vestibular bulbs in a book that just blew my mind, New View of a Woman's Body, that came out originally in the late 70s, these radical feminist lay health workers. And there was a chapter about female genitalia, and they talked about the vestibular bulbs. And I still remember looking at it and going, so what? I've never heard of these. How could I have not heard of these? And then immediately looking at my own body. Do I have those, really? And literally playing with myself, getting them engorged, going, oh, my gosh, once they're engorged, they're right there. I can totally feel them. And so many light bulbs went off in my head. Like, oh, that's why it would feel good when someone had their thigh pressed up against my crotch. Right? Mm. Oh, that's what was getting stimulated. Oh, I get it. And, yeah, that's what started me off going, well, if I didn't know about this, and I'm an expert in this equipment, A, what else don't I know? What else is missing from our picture? And how come we don't know? How come we don't know this? That's crazy.
Well, you know, I can say a similar thing. You know, I've been, at the time I heard you talk about this in Monterey, I had at that point been in the field over 30 years, and I have read academically. I know a lot. My library is filled with books about sexuality that I have read, and clinically seen thousands of clients over the years, and then my own experience. So this was also new to me and very exciting. I will always give you credit for the vestibular bulbs. What a magical and wonderful finding, really.
Well, you know, thank you. Yes. Thank you for the credit, and also keep in mind I stand on the shoulders of other, you know, of giants who came before me and got me started or did original research that I then was able to find and start kind of putting together this whole new map. So I feel like I'm in a line of people who are helping us become more genitally aware. And so, and I think also, just to get back to the earlier point we were making about learning and the stories that we hold, I think once you are aware of all those parts of your genitals and how they work and making them work, I think that's also an amazing way to really heal your relationship with your genitals, because once you know all about that, it's so delightful and wonderful and exciting and beautiful that I think that really also helps us bust through the shame and the, oh, my genitals are ugly and funny looking negative messages that we have.
Yeah, and you say in your book on page 41 about the sexual stories, well, you have a number of things that I think are worth exploring here. What your stories and beliefs do have about your, what do they have about your relationships? Am I missing a word here? Do you expect Prince Charming to arrive someday and sweep you off your feet? I remember reading years ago a myth that a lot of women believed, and this was actually, this came out in a pre-orgasmic group that I led for a number of years when I was in California, and it was this, someday my prince will come, and so will I. You know, they wanted to have orgasms, but they had this Prince Charming kind of a myth in their mind, and that probably wasn't going to be the magic charm for becoming orgasmic. You also say, is Sleeping Beauty waiting for you to kiss her awake? So that would be the male. Mm-hmm. And are you planning on finding your soulmate, you ask, on living happily ever after?
Living happily ever after and coming happily ever after.
That's just
not how it works, right? We learn to be orgasmic, and then we can teach a partner how they can help facilitate that process. But that expectation that a lot of women have that my partner will make me come, and he knows what to do to make it happen, is unfair, especially if we partner with men. They don't have a clue. Their bodies are different. They operate very different operating system. You know, it's like a Mac and a PC, or, know, a microwave oven and a regular yeah. oven, right? Really different operating systems here. And and then, you know, we feel either like there's something wrong with us or there's something wrong with them, instead of recognizing there's stuff we haven't learned. We need to unlearn some things that are blocking us and stopping us. We need to learn new things. And one of the things, when we have that healthy relationship with our own sexuality, when we've looked at our stories, when we've rewritten them in positive ways and discovered our potential, you know, that's when we're going to, I mean, you know, live happily ever after is really, that's when we're going to have the kind of satisfying, intimate and sexual relationships. And that whole happily ever after thing, why, nobody's happy ever after. Who came up with that idea?
Well, it's fairy tale.
Well, yeah, we were raised on them, though, weren't we?
Yeah. You ask a question.
The fairy tale doesn't end. And then they got into a long-term significant relationship, and they worked on their things, and stuff came up, and they learned together, and they worked through it, or they didn't.
Right. But the process is interesting. We're talking about sexual history now and stories, and I've had clients tell me over the years, that like one woman who'd had a lot of sexual partners, a young woman, early 30s, she said she wanted to feel seductive of men and in control. And so she didn't have very long relationships, and she said something very significant. I see now that I was afraid to feel too much. And some women kind of take that another step, and they will have sex with married men. And, you know, we're not necessarily recommending this, but for this woman, it was a way to have sex and to be able to let herself go emotionally because it was safe. He was married, and she could let herself go. Have you come across stories like that?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, as I know that as a therapist for you and as a teacher for me, the reasons people make the choices that they make are complicated, particularly with sex and love and intimacy. And I think a lot of it goes back to, again, what we learned, especially when we were very young, about what love, what the flavor of love is. What's safe and what's
like that.
Not safe,
right?
So the first year of life, you know, if, for example, you had parents who were very narcissistic and didn't pay attention to you, or parents, a primary caregiver who was depressed, or, you know, all of those things, you learned maybe that love was cold and critical and, you know, didn't pay attention, and then you're going to try and replicate that. This is the sort of classic imago work that Harville Hendricks teaches about, that we tend to look in our primary relationships for people who will replicate the patterns of our primary caregivers, often the negative ones. And again, this is where we have the potential to change and heal and grow. We start looking at it and going, oh, I see, I found, you know, a man who was really wimpy, just like my dad, or a man or a partner who was really critical, just like my mom. And then, of course, we get all triggers when they're, you know, wimpy or critical or whatever it is that that we actually are looking for in the first place. So, again, this gets into what are my stories about sex, about love, what makes me feel safe, what makes me feel excited, what turns me on. There's so much information that we can learn by looking at sort of what's our turn-ons. And then the thing is we can learn and grow and change. We're not stuck with whatever we've got.
And that's very important, Sherry. Lots of people mm-hmm. don't get that. You and I have talked about this in the past, but you can you talk about learnable, that sexuality is not, you're not stuck with it. And so you have to then ask, what can we learn about it and about our own sexuality? And I think a lot of people would be relieved to learn that they're not stuck. I'm thinking about a small study of sex therapists, and they were wondering if sex therapists had better sex than the general population. And it was a small study, but it turned out that they did, because they could have sex without anxiety. They had so much knowledge, and they could relax into it and communicate better. And I think that that's true. I think that all the years I've been a sex therapist, and it's helped my own personal sexuality grow too. What do you think about that, having sex without anxiety and relaxing into it, and because you have knowledge and so on?
Well, two things. One is, first of all, just to be clear, everyone has their challenges. So even when we know all these things,
yeah,
as a teacher, as a therapist, that doesn't mean it's all rainbows. There's
right,
still work
right.
to be done and things to learn and grow. However, I think the more tools we have for
mm-hmm.
understanding ourselves, understanding our partner, the more we learn about psychology and how humans operate, and the more we learn about communication. I mean, I've studied the last couple of years really focusing a lot on what's called nonviolent communication or compassionate communication.
Mm-hmm.
The more of that we do, the more fun, pleasure, and great sex we're going to have with ourselves and our partners, because anxiety blocks arousal. It's as simple as that.
Yes, absolutely.
Anxiety and fear, also, resentment, things like that, they will block arousal. And
mm-hmm.
So when we learn what we can do to manage our anxiety or have less anxiety, less fear, the easier it's going to be to get turned on and have great pleasure. So I learned that as a midwife, right? You want to have
sure.
a great labor. And labor and arousal are basically the same altered state of consciousness. They are the same trance state, and the same things will block it. If you feel anxious, if you feel ashamed, you're going to be inhibited. It's going to block arousal, block the hormones that get you into that altered state. And again, there's something we can do about it. And
mm-hmm.
isn't that
mm-hmm.
great that we have that potential to do that? So great.
So with my second child, he was born 7 minutes after I got to the hospital. So my first child was 3 hours.
You're one of them.
Labor, which isn't bad. Yeah, so
3 hours
was
for your first baby?
My first,
oh,
I know, isn't that, aren't I something? I guess
that's amazing.
Well, I was at Sanford Hospital, a very good hospital, a teaching hospital, and they brought in a bunch of residents learning to watch me give birth. So clearly,
well,
I was okay
people,
with that.
Many people that would
mm-hmm.
really screw it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
You were things were going so well, and you were already deep in your trance, and it didn't mess
mm-hmm.
it up. But one of the reasons we've got
mm-hmm.
such messed up birth in this country is because we disrupt the trance state. So again, the same
oh.
thing. I do a whole class and a whole thing about how, you know, labor is actually a sexual experience, and the same things will help us have great sex, will help us have great labor, which is feeling safe, comfortable, respected, honored, taken care of. All of those same
mm.
things can lead to great, fantastic sex and great, fantastic labor. And it's all learnable. All learnable. Yay for learning.
All learnable.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That is fascinating. I think we should also talk about a lot of the time what puts a woman in the mood has nothing to do with her genitals or any of these other things, that it requires getting her in the mood requires engaging her mind and psyche as much as engaging her engorging her body parts, to have her mind and body, because the pleasure that we have often of non-penile touches, nibbles, kisses, insertions, and licks, we hope that some of these will produce orgasms, the more the better, but whatever, I think it's important for women to understand that all of these things are not just a prelude to anything, but they are the point, call them what they are, sex. So, yeah, it's the mind-body thing, and it's also all the other kinds of foreplay things that we can think about. But you don't necessarily like the word foreplay. I was just going to say. I bet you don't like the word foreplay. We might have even talked about this at some point.
We might have, but my partner and I reframe that. We call it warm up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, we're
that's
getting
good.
Everything
I like that.
Warm. The same way, if you're gonna go exercise, you want to warm up first, right? It's about getting things loose and getting the blood flow and getting into your body. The whole experience, the whole erotic journey that you go on by yourself or with a partner is all sex. And so, I think that's
it's all
important.
Sex.
And I think really reframing that can be useful, because if we've got a partner who's really more focused on the destination, the penetrative sex, the orgasm, and we're trying to enjoy the journey, we're not going to be on the same page. This gets to the partner skills that we were talking about. But having the conversations about what you like, what works for you, what kind of time frame works, what turns you on, how you like to warm up, all of those conversations are so useful, because then you can all be on the same page about what you're doing. If you haven't communicated about it, your partner might think, oh, if I take too long, she's going to get bored, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or it's my job to push things along. And or if we don't hurry up and have intercourse, I might lose my erection, right?
That's a
but
big
once
one.
We once we have conversations, we can say things like, well, erections come and erections go. So if it's there at some point, great. And if you lose your erection and get soft for a while, that's okay, too. There's lots of fun things to do. And we can probably find a way to help it come back when we're at the point where intercourse might be a wonderful thing. So I think, again, if we stop making sex about what you do with a penis and a vagina, and that the thing to do with it is, put one inside the other. If we reframe that into sex is this whole journey, all the different ways we can pleasure each other, and getting wherever we go, when we get there, how we get there is good. So that's
this is very important information. Very important, because a lot of men often go directly to the genitals, and this precludes perhaps a slow build-up, which might involve more of her erogenous zones, the back of her neck, her inner thighs, and her arms. Really, and that can really warm her up. And Dr. Laura Berman said, and she's a, I don't see her much anymore, but years ago I did, and we both presented a paper in Spain in about 97. Oh, my goodness, a long time ago. She says, if men are microwaves, women are slow-cooking ovens. And that's very true. It's a good way to conceptualize it.
And you know, one of my maps that I like to use is the pussycats and puppy dogs model, right?
Yeah, talk about that.
More like pussycats, right? And if you want to, if you come over to my house and you want to befriend my kitty cat, you don't run up to her and grab her and try and rub her belly, right? She'll claw you and run away.
Yeah.
Right? But you want to start with the connection, and you go, and you make eye contact and you show that you're safe and you approach slowly and you do it in attunement with her signals of whether she's relaxing and opening or tightening and tensing. And the women tend to have that core pussycat kind of energy. And and most men, their core erotic energy is more like a puppy dog. They're friendly and enthusiastic, and they're focused on the goal, and they love to have a job. But for most dogs, you know, you could have them on their back and be rubbing their belly in about 30 seconds, right?
Right.
So
I think that's a very good model. It tells the story very well.
You know, I teach whole classes and programs working with that model, because that one actually goes so deep. There's so many pieces of that model. But if we want to help men be what I call the high masculine, the best model for that is the seeing eye dog, the service
dog.
Wow. Right?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm listening.
Right? Isn't that a beautiful model? The service animal who's focused on being in service, who's in attunement with their person and is leading and guiding them in a safe, attentive way, focused on taking care of their person. And that's the high masculine. And the low masculine is the badly behaved dog. You know, the one that you go to your friend's house and the dog jumps up on you and knocks you over and starts humping your leg.
Yeah.
Right? And that's dog energy at its two different extremes. And so if we help people who have that core puppy dog energy, that is usually men, but not always, but usually, help them frame our erotic journey together as they're being like the service dog, and they're in attunement, and they're helping guide us and focus us, and their job is to safely, you know, go on this journey with us in a pleasurable way. And then we can recognize, you know, with that framework, we have this wonderful framework of what is what's going to work, and that way
what's going to work.
What's going to work? Because that's really the question.
Yeah.
It's not is it right or wrong, is it good or bad. It's what's going to work. What is going to, or really play right? What's going to play?
What's going to play? Yeah,
want to have right. And again, that is a great reframing for a sexual encounter, because sometimes things just don't work. Sometimes we hit a snag, we get derailed, we miscommunicate, and instead of framing it as, oh, it's a failure, it's a disaster, so, oh, that didn't work. All right, what would work? And I think that's important, because even when we've got a great partner that we've had awesome sex with, sometimes it's just not going to work. It doesn't mean we got it wrong or we failed, right?
That's right. And I think that there are some good questions to ask post-coitally or after any kind of sexual intimacy, and questions that I think are important. So you ask, was it enjoyable? Did you feel close to each other? How can you make it better, even better next time? And so with these kinds of questions, with this kind of spirit about it, you're less likely to worry about success or failure and more likely to appreciate the rich range of experiences that sex has to offer. Sex has to offer just a whole range of pleasures.
It's so true. We like to do something we call running the highlights tape, like after a sporting event. Yes, you know. And we'll say three or four things that happened or moments or something that we really enjoyed. And it could be, you know, oh, that moment when you looked up and you looked in my eyes and put your hand on my heart. Oh, gosh, I felt so close to you. And it might also be, oh, that moment when you said that raunchy thing right when we were in the, you know, really going at it.
Yeah.
Oh, man, was it a turn on, right?
Yeah.
So it's about really pointing out the positives And also, it's a great way to go, oh, okay, I'm going to remember that. I'm going to remember you really liked that particular move or action or kind of touch or play. And so make sure that we incorporate that more. So I think that's a great, you know, sort of post-sex conversation, running the highlight tape, we call it.
And I like it, running the highlight.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that,
and
yeah,
then
that's good.
Yeah. And then
and
another thing, which
and before sex
is useful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, before sex, in terms, we've been talking about good communication. So before sex, I would say it's really important to avoid psychic sex, you know, because a lot of people somehow believe that if you really loved me, you should know. And I point out that it's like going on a treasure hunt without any clues, because communication is necessary, and I think it's especially necessary when you can, in the light of day, when you can see your partner's face and subtle reactions. And I coach some of my clients to say, you know, I was reading an article, or and I realized that there were some things that I don't know about what you enjoy in bed, and I want to create that kind of pleasure for you. So you, then she or he, they can describe what draws him or her, you to him or her, and how that makes you feel. And I think that kind of more transparent communication can really be helpful. You drop the mask, and you're just yourself. And I say that the four-letter word that would help a lot of people have really incredibly better sex, what if they could do more of, it's not F-U-C-K, it's T-A-L-K. T-A-L-K.
I'm so with you. So with you on that.
I know.
So I think that the message, just to hammer it home, really, there are no psychic partners. They don't know what you want. They don't know what you like. They don't know what you don't want and don't like. And not knowing doesn't mean that they don't love you or they're not connected or that they don't care. It's just nobody knows. It changes all the time anyway. Even if there's something you like today, you might not like it tomorrow. So I just say that exact thing. There are no psychic lovers. And I think, so another strategy, talking and learning strategies that I often suggest to people is doing what I tend to call a playpen, some people call it a sandbox, but it's setting up a specific time and space for playing learning games. So, for example, you might have had an encounter where something didn't work, and rather than stopping and just trying to figure it all out, you know, maybe you just move on. But then later you can go, you know, when I asked you to go slow, and you know, when I said I'd like you to start at my foot and slowly go up my leg till you get to my crotch, and then you kissed my ankle, kissed my knee, and then you were back at my crotch in about 20 seconds. I realize that you and I might have different definitions of the word slow.
And that's also a very sweet and kind way to reframe it.
Right. Not like you really screwed up or you didn't listen to me.
Right.
Because I could get triggered and feel like, I just asked you to go slow and you didn't go slow. And I could go into, you're not paying attention or there's something wrong with you. Right. So instead we can frame it as, let's have a play shop where we play with what these words mean, and so that we can have better communication. So at the play shop, like I said, we set a time and a space and a framework. So it might be, let's take 10 minutes or let's take a half hour and let's create a game. How's this sound for a game? I'll say the word fast, and then I'll stroke your leg in what I consider fast, and then I'll say the word slow, and I'll stroke it what I think of as slow, and then maybe I'll say really slow and show you that, and then maybe I'll go super slow and show you that, and then you do it back to me, and we'll do that for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then we'll talk about it. And how's that sound for a play shop? And
I like it a lot, play shop.
Right?
And I like how you frame it, yeah.
Yeah, and you can have a whole day play shop where we have a day where we give each other abundant, enthusiastic affirmations and positivity, right?
Mm.
Right, so it doesn't have to even, you know, we can have a play shop for an hour where we play with foot massage. We can have a play shop for an hour where I show you, do a show and tell with my genitals, and I show you how I like to touch myself. And maybe one play shop is just me showing you. Maybe then we do a second one where I show you and then you do it, and then we work together to communicate about it so that you get to the point where you can touch me in the ways that I just love the most. Right? Maybe that's 10 play shops. There's no limit. But it creates this time and space to talk about and learn about our sexual relationship while we're not actually having the spontaneous, creative sex play that we usually do. So I love to include that framework of having play shops.
You've given me some excellent ideas to expand some of the homework that I give my clients to do at home.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of a play shop, it also can work with things like kissing, because I do have some women who say, oh, he's not kissing me the way that I would like, and so I suggest that experiment with playful kisses and kiss him or her the way you enjoy being kissed, and you might pause mid-kiss and say, I love the way this feels. And then she might say, hey, you show me what it feels like to be kissed by me just now. So it's the back and forth. And some of the same ideas with your play shop.
I love that. And kissing is one of those things that, you know, how did we learn to kiss? Well, I mean, how did we learn to do any of this? We watched movies, right? We read romance novels or we watched porn. Whatever it is, we didn't learn communication skills. We probably didn't learn good sexual technique, good pleasurable technique. So kissing is a great play shop to have. In fact, I can imagine, you know, let's come up with how many different kinds of ways we like kissing. Because sometimes I want that really slow build up where you know, you gaze in my eyes and you come in very slowly, and then you just almost like don't quite touch my lips, and then you kiss me so softly, you know. So we could come up with a name for that. We could have that be like the you know, I don't know, the slow kiss. And then sometimes, you know, especially at high level arousal, I want like a really sexual, you know, intensity in the kiss. Like how many different ways could we, like, or sometimes, like, I want you to, like, grab my hair and, you know, and hold me down and kiss, you know, like how many different kinds of kisses could we come up with that we like? And then we even get, you know, we can even have the ability to, you know, say, oh, right now, I would love that slow kiss. Oof, that would be so delicious right now. And again, the more we can talk about it, learn about it, the more we expand our ability to get what we want and find what works and create an ongoing erotic learning relationship, which is really the goal, right? It's not like we're going to just be there. It's that we want to keep growing and changing, and And I'll just add, if we stay with a partner for a while, everything's going to change because we're going to get older.
Right, and we have to lessen our assumptions and make room for adjusting to maybe changing bodies and that sort of thing. Back to the kissing for a minute, because I encounter this with a lot of the couples I see where, oh, they've been married a while, and I'll say, how often do you kiss? Oh, we don't kiss much anymore, and then we explore that a little bit. And mm-hmm. it often turns out that the woman feels that she wants soft lips to begin with until she's more aroused. She does not want the tongue to go down her throat immediately. That just doesn't feel good for most women, unless she's really turned on. So I often mm-hmm. suggest that they try soft lips first. And of course, your play shop idea here serves this concept very well, because she can say, this is what I'm going to show you what I'd like. And she can demonstrate the soft lips and maybe the tongue just making an outline around the lips, that sort of thing.
Yes, it gets back to the pussycats. Pussycats, generally speaking, like a slow approach, an attuned approach. You've got to, give them pleasure, create safety, be attuned to what's working. And that's usually the kind of kissing that we like, that feels attuned, that feels, attentive. Right? And again, we get back to the dog. The seeing-eye dog is totally attuned to their person, right? And that's the kind of kissing we want. We want attuned kissing.
Attuned, yeah. The seeing-eye dog. Yeah. Those are some beautiful analogies with the cat and the dog. And I like that a lot, and the seeing-eye dog. Being attuned is really, really important in general, to being really plugged into, some people have trouble with this, but being plugged into one's partner and being in sync is another way of talking about this. And, Brian, my husband, talks about syncing up. A skilled lover plugs into a woman's breath and her pelvic thrust, and he follows her lead. And I think, and he also says, and of course I'm in total agreement because I've experienced it, listen to her vocalizations. Because there may be a pattern, and you can match your movements to that rhythm. And so maybe rather than the old in and out, the man can try rotating his hips, and it'll make for perhaps a different kind of clitoral stimulation. And the absence of thrusting will help some men last longer, so they'll change the pattern. But they're syncing up; they're really plugging in to their female partner.
Yeah, and I would say, what I would say about that same idea about, being in tune and being in sync is that there's always two pieces to it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are being the puppy dog, and we even change these roles sometimes, even though I'm a core pussycat kind of woman, sometimes I'm in a puppy dog mood, right? So it's absolute. But whichever I'm being, the yin or the yang, we could say, is that if I'm the partner who's receiving pleasure, so if my partner is doing something to me that's pleasurable, it's my job as the receiver to do what I call responsible responses. That is, if my partner's doing something that feels good, it's my job to be responsive, to breathe in a way that my partner can hear, to make sounds of pleasure, to move. And so by responding to the pleasure, I'm giving my partner that feedback, right? Mm-hmm. So they need to be attuned, so my partner needs to be attuned to me. I need to give them the positive messages when things are working. So the all of the things that you're talking about tuning into, it's my job to do that. So if I was just lying there being quiet, if I wasn't moving, if I was breathing in a way that my partner could barely hear me or know what's going on with my breath, it's going to be really hard for them to attune with me. So the young person or the puppy dog person, their job at that moment is to be attentive and attuned. And my job as the receiving person at that moment, or the pussycat person or the yin person,
yeah,
is to be responsibly responsive to what's going on. And this is great play shot material because you can take turns being both partners, right? So I could give my partner a foot massage, and his job in that play shop is to move, to make sounds of pleasure, to give verbal positive feedback and let me know what's working. And then we can switch roles. And that way each person gets to be in each role, and we learn how to be more and more in attunement because we're giving big, good, clear signals to each other, and we're being in attention. So that's the piece I would add to that.
And you have so much information and words of wisdom based on years of experience, clinical and experiential and so on. So the show is about to end, and as usual, Sherry, I want to have you back soon, so we'll talk about that off the air. And I just, to kind of look at your book, you have on page 290, Succulent Summary. The thing that I think would be helpful to end this show with is what you say: pleasure is an evolutionary strategy for surviving and thriving. You need only to think of a newborn ecstatic at their mother's breasts. So glad I got to experience that. We desire to connect, to be nourished, to be loved, safe and warm. And that is all good. So there's the music. So we'll have to end it on your quote. I'll be in touch with you, Sherry. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a great show. Appreciate it. Bye-bye, everybody. My boy Getty, da, 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 da.